Hey, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of The Julia LaRose Show. We have a returning guest and a friend of the show. We are joined today by Carol Roth. She is a recovering investment banker. She is a small business expert and a New York Times best-selling author, and I should note multiple times. And in this conversation, we get Carol's update on where we are when it comes to the economy and why the picture is not so pretty. We also got her take on the Federal Reserve, their monetary policy, and why she thinks that we are already in fiscal dominance. This is a topic that has come up many times on this channel. And I mentioned earlier that Carol is a small business expert, and she gives us the state of small business today, and it does not look good. I really enjoyed this conversation with Carol. I always learn something from her, and I know you will too. Carol Roth, a recovering investment banker, a small business expert, a New York Times best-selling author, I should note multiple times, including for your newest book, You Will Own Nothing, which was such a great read. It is so great to welcome you back to the show, Carol, for your third appearance. Thank you so much for taking the time to join me again.
Thank you. I love being with you. And I feel like the third time is very special. You know, at restaurants, when you're like a special customer, you get your name like on a plaque by a booth or something. So I feel like I need like a plaque on the wall or something.
Yeah, we need like the name tags they bring out. I've seen folks that have like their names carved into steak knives. We need some sort of
special thing.
Yeah,
exactly.
Definitely a friend of the show. And also, I've mentioned this before, but my first like live TV appearance, you were on set with me. And so I will never forget that.
Well, you did amazing. And to watch you like become this media powerhouse has just been, it's just been fantastic. I feel like a little verklempt, you know, like so proud. It's like, oh, look what Julia's done. So amazing.
You're way too kind. Well, you've always been part of that journey. Okay. So I want to start where I always start. And that is to get the big picture, you know, more of the macro update, your assessment of the economy. And Carol, as you know, we could take all the time you need on this show to set the table when it comes to the picture as it relates to the economy. What does that look like for you today?
Well, anybody who's watching the video feed of this will see that I've got very big 80s hair and sort of like a distressed jacket. And this is my throwback to the early 70s, kind of late 70s, early 80s, because, you know, this stagflationary 70s, 80s kind of economy is making a resurgence. So I thought I would just dress up for the occasion. One of the things that has frustrated me as I've been doing commentary for the last, you know, several years is this idea that we would have all of this intervention in the economy and there would be no repercussions, that there would be, you know, nothing on the other side of that. We would just be able to manage around that. And I think that we're finally starting to see cracks in the story and kind of explain, you know, what has been misinterpreted. I think over the last year, or the 15 years that we had, you know, ZIRP or close to ZIRP in the last couple of years, early on, one of the things that was sort of misstated was the idea that even though we had this highly interventionist Fed, that there was no inflation. And I've argued for a long time, I argued it two books ago and before that, that that wasn't the case, that we had massive inflation, but that inflation was in assets and it was in the stock market, it was in homes. And so the people who hadn't assets and benefited from that kind of loved it and didn't really view it that way. And it wasn't until some of the recent policy, some of the direct stimulus to consumers and some of the other decisions where we saw that inflation migrate just from the asset side to sort of everyday cost of living. And then it's like, oh, look, we have this inflation, which, you know, I would contend has been going on for a long time. So I think that's one thing that we have to kind of look at. The other thing is this idea that we've had this amazing economy. And I really feel like the economy has been very much window dressed, and we're starting to see a little crack in that window dressing. They're starting to run out of decorations, so to speak, Julia. And if you look back at just, let's say, last year, last fiscal year, the government ran deficits to GDP that were, depending on, you know, what you count the deficit, I say it was $2 trillion because there was an accounting little trickery that was going on there, but they really spent $2 trillion. So deficits to GDP were like 7%+. And that is, you know, double the historic average. And when you think about, going back in history, if you have expansion, that should be reducing the deficit, right? You're collecting more money that's able to pay down the deficits and cover some of the spending. But what they've done is the opposite. They tried to use deficit spending to show that we had this incredible quote unquote economy. And that was incredibly expensive, not just in terms of the dollars of the deficit, but now they have to finance it at the highest rates that we've seen in, you know, 15, 17 years. So now that we've got some data points coming out here in 2024, Q1, that 1.6% was almost a full percentage point less than the street expected. We had the April jobs report that, you know, was not as robust as expected. I think we're starting to see diminishing returns on all of that excess spending. And I think that really can shine a light for the people who haven't glommed onto this already, that there really hasn't been this amazing economy. It has been a deficit-driven economy, very expensive, and we are paying the price for that quite literally today, and we'll continue to do so in the future.
Yeah, that was going to be my follow-on question is, if the growth has been all driven by the deficit spending, at some point, we're going to have to pay for that. And also makes you wonder, like, it's really not sustainable either.
No, I mean, the word sustainable is one that has come up, actually, the opposite of it, non-sustainable, a lot. And you've had pretty much every entity and, you know, high-profile person that exists saying that the fiscal situation of the United States isn't sustainable. It's the IMF. It's the CBO. It's the Treasury. It's the Fed. It's Jamie Dimon. It's Nassim Taleb. You know, like anyone and everyone has said, you know, you'd have to be kind of crazy to say, no, I think this is entirely sustainable. And we're seeing even just the interest on the debt. You know, the last estimate that I've seen that is, if we don't do anything to interest rates and we don't do anything to change sort of the spending, that we're on track for $1.7 trillion in interest expense over the next 12 months, which puts it potentially as the biggest line item on the federal budget. And so what does that say about a country whose biggest expense is interest on their debt? That is not a healthy situation. That is not a sustainable situation. And so the challenge is, there's this giant elephant in the room. We all see it. And nobody is like, hey, maybe we should get the elephant out of the room. And that's the challenge, is that we don't have the political will, and we don't have enough pressure from individuals. You know, that people are freaking out about a lot of things, and there are plenty of things to freak out about. But like, when's the last time we saw a march in the streets, you know, on the Fed or on the fiscal situation or about the debt? Like, never. So until that becomes an issue that politicians say we can't find a way around anymore, and I don't think anything's going to be done. And we have a large part of the population that's financially illiterate. So it's a huge, huge challenge. And it really is going to change the tenor of what is possible, you know, for us in the future in terms of our wealth, our quality of life, our access to commodities, you know, things just kind of working. And I don't think particularly, you know, in Wall Street circles where everything is great and people have benefited, I don't think that there's a bit of a full wake-up call in some of those circles.
And that wake-up call, that would be moving us into fiscal dominance. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, we could have this argument that we probably already are in fiscal dominance, or we're really close to the edge of it. But, you know, for people who don't know what that means, it's exactly what it sounds like, right? It's that the fiscal policy dominates the monetary policy. And I would make that contention right now. I think the Fed is in a giant pickle, is my nicest way I can say it, is that if they were to lower interest rates, I actually think if they lowered it a bit, it really wouldn't do anything. It's not like we're going to have this giant boom if they lowered it 50 basis points. But, you know, over time, as they lower interest rates, we know that that can be inflationary. At the same time, if they do nothing or they continue to raise interest rates, then we have all of this interest that we have to pay on our debt. not just the new deficit, the deficit financing, but we have a lot of refinancing that needs to be done on our national debt. And we have been issuing a crazy amount at the front end of the curve because there aren't enough buyers at a reasonable price, you know, for longer duration treasuries. So we have just this massive refinancing that needs to go over and over and over again. And at continually higher rates, and that average goes up, that in and itself is going to end up being inflationary. The Fed, in my opinion, is going to be the only buyer left standing at any interest rate that would be acceptable. And so, yeah, I do think that we are in or near fiscal dominance. And I think that this inflation outlook that we've been talking about, stagflation or whatever it is something that's just going to be with us for a long time, because the federal government is moving in the exact opposite direction that the Fed has been trying to get everybody else to move for several years now.
Yeah. Well, on the fiscal dominance conversation, you are in good company. We've had Professor Charles Kalamiris, Luke Groman, Lynn Alden all discuss this topic. It's a topic our audience is deeply interested in, so I know they're excited to have you on. You also mentioned stagflation. We just had the FOMC earlier this month. I'm sure you saw Fed Chair Jerome Powell say he doesn't see the stag or the flation. Can we just get your reaction to, let's just go back to the Fed. And I want to get your assessment, your reaction, and maybe even let's throw in there, maybe a bit of your outlook on rates, maybe in the near term, the next couple of meetings ahead of the election. Let's just start there.
So, I mean, this is the same Fed that told us that there would be no inflation. Inflation is going to be transitory. There's a path to a soft landing. I mean, what are they going to say? I mean, I know they're supposed to be quote unquote independent. If anyone believes that, they haven't been forceful enough in putting it to the federal government going, listen, guys, we've run out of tools here. This is all in your corner. You need to do something. That's what I would love to hear from the Fed. But we know we're never going to hear that. What they have done, and you know, they signaled it and they keep kind of pushing it, is saying that, well, we might not be able to do anything with interest rates, but we certainly do have the balance sheet as a tool. And where, you know, we saw that they were, you know, doing some quantitative tightening, they're starting to move away from that. They're gonna take it a little bit easy on that, even more than we had expected and they had telegraphed. So I think that just goes to show you, you know, that they are moving in a more accommodative direction out of need and trying to do so in a way where people, you know, don't go, well, this is going to create inflation and create that expectation and make that a self-fulfilling prophecy, because most people aren't really paying attention to the Fed in general. But when they do, they certainly aren't paying attention to the balance sheet conversations if they know it. One thing we know, you mentioned Luke Groman, whose research I love and yeah, read, and has just, you know, so many things on my radar, really appreciate him. One thing that he's put out previously, which he may have discussed with you in his appearance, is just who has been a buyer of the U.S. debt for the last decade. And, you know, we have seen the national debt almost double from, you know, it was about 16 trillion 10 years ago to, you know, the mammoth that is today. And basically, if you look at central banks around the world, they have been over the same period of time net sellers. They're actually down about $100 billion in treasury. So where we used to be able to look to central banks to help us finance our debt, that has really been net off the table in terms of who's been in selling and netting that out over the last 10 years, which means you do have, you know, some foreign buyers, and obviously you have the banks. We know the primary dealers have been getting stuck with more and more of the debt. But, you know, as we look at this, you know, sort of unsustainable picture, we see the Fed doing more. And just the fact that, you know, now they're not quite letting as much run off the balance sheet, and they are going back and buying a little bit to supplement what's on the balance sheet, you know, I think that just gives you an idea of where their head's at and the reality that they're facing in terms of all of this debt that needs financing, new or existing. And you know, who the buyers are, what the appetite is at any interest rate that would be palatable.
Yeah, that's a good point too. On the Fed front as well, on the rate policy, I had an interesting conversation with Jim Bianco, and basically the window before the election. So there's the June meeting,
July.
July. Like, so as we get closer to the election, I think it was whatever the policy is going to be, whether it's a hike or a cut. Basically, it was like if they don't do something at the June meeting, like the door kind of closes or something for them to do anything. I guess otherwise it might be viewed as like political or whatnot. I might not be summarizing that quite correctly, but what's more of your outlook for rates? Because remember at the beginning of the year, a lot of folks were expecting six cuts this year.
Yeah, I mean, I think that many of us always thought that that was a little bit insane and ahead of things. The Fed, they have all these crazy programs and all these things they do and make up to try to be opaque. I think if they don't do something by July, I think it will be very hard for them to do anything. I think they will sit tight probably in terms of the election. They may telegraph something a little bit, but I don't think that they want to be perceived to be political in either direction. So I do kind of agree with that. But I do think the balance sheet conversation is probably more important. And I would be paying attention to that because, there will be, if data continues to trend in what we're seeing here, it does give them enough cover to say, well, we're going to at least cut a little bit. And again, I mean, do you really think, Julia, that if they cut 25 basis points, 50 basis points, even 100, do you think that that's going to unleash the economy in some special way? Like, I don't really see that happening. So I think they have some room. It's not like they're going from 5.25 to 2. If you go from 5.25 to, 4.75, does that really change the dynamic of the economy other than just, creating some optimism for the street? So, I think they have a little bit more room than perhaps, some other people do. I think that there's some data out there. So could they throw a little something out there? It's possible, but they just may really focus on that balance sheet side. And again, both of the tools, are doing the same things. You can be accommodative either way. So that just may be their backdoor way to get this done.
That makes sense. Okay, so going back to the balance sheet, though, in the conversation around treasuries, can you frame up the argument one more time for us just to better understand it and why that is so important to pay attention to?
Well, I think that, and again, this goes back to, who is it that if we're having $2 trillion a year deficits, plus we have all of this short-dated debt that is coming due over and over again and needs to be refinanced, who is it that's standing by that is like able to suck up this data or this debt? So we know that it's not central banks on net that we have these, countries that are lightening their loads. Maybe there are some that are adding, but when you net it all out, they are no longer the ones who are financing the U.S. government. So you certainly have some foreign buyers. You have the banks, which sometimes it's shoved down their throat, and other primary dealers in the financial system. And then you have, folks like you and me who, I've certainly been, laddering, short duration T-bills instead of, with cash to just kind of see what's going on. But that sucks capital away from other things in the economy. So it's not like it, something that you can do. And again, it doesn't have a consequence. I think that's the theme here is that, whatever is done always has a consequence and you have to pay attention to that. So as this, continues on over long periods of time, it's pretty clear that the Fed is going to be the only one who is going to buy treasuries, at a rate that is appropriate, when you have that supply and demand imbalance in the treasury market and there's much more supply and not enough demand at a certain price, what happens? Rates have to go up in order to entice that demand. Like, we don't want to see in the bond market, the 10-year go to 8%. That would be not palatable. So you would imagine that the Fed would step in and start buying it. And whether it's called, come pick a name, QE, yield curve control, Powell's new special, Save the Treasury program. I mean, they always make up these little programs and names, to hide what it is that they're doing. I think that's the reality of it, is that we got lots of debt that needs to be financed, and so it needs to go somewhere. And the most likely scenario, given the lay of the land and the math, is that over time, near term, the Fed is going to have to be that buyer. And to do that, what do they have to do? They have to print money, and that is inflationary. So a very sad tale, but, you know, math is math.
Yeah. Okay. So one thing that central banks have been buying lately, it's been gold. And yes. I know this is an area you write on, and yeah. This audience loves hearing about gold as well. So what is your take on gold today?
So it's interesting, as we've had this conversation, that the central banks around the world have been lightening up on treasuries. It's not like they're going into another reserve currency, right? It's not like they're the supplementing and say, well, no treasuries, but we'll buy the euro or we'll buy something else. What they have been basically netting that with is gold. And so we see central banks really stockpiling it. And in many cases, like if you look at the BRICS, and particularly led by China and Russia, Russia, who the dollar has been entirely weaponized against, and China, who has lots of concerns, there are lots of reasons why they don't want to depend on the dollar, right? They've got, if you have food, you have, you know, energy priced in dollars, and that the dollar is getting more and more expensive for them, that threatens their security. Food security, national security, economic security, you know, for somebody like Russia, where we're just like, hey, you can't hack access to your reserves. And oh, by the way, we're just going to give all that money to Ukraine potentially. You know, who wants to let the U.S. hold and manage the reserve currency if that's the outcome and they can use it to hold you hostage? So I think that these countries are looking and saying, like, how can we affect trade? And certainly they can trade amongst themselves. But when there's something that needs to be settled, you know, there's a leftover balance. One of those countries may not want the yuan or you know, the ruble or one of these other currencies. So gold becomes a natural way to settle that out. And if everybody has been buying up gold and we agree that, hey, this is something that we all think has value, it's got a 5,000-year social contract and is a fairly neutral reserve asset, then maybe that starts to play a bigger role. And so I think that's the thesis. There are other theses, you know, rolling around that, you know, this is a great way to potentially inflate away the debt and manage the debt problems, that basically, as has happened several times in history before, that there is some sort of agreement, or, you know, maybe China sort of starts to reset the prices. And they say, hey, we don't want to mess with our currency, but we can all benefit if we just change the value of gold. And so there's, you know, a thought that maybe that could happen over time. And then all of a sudden, in terms of what your dollars or other currency can buy in terms of gold, now everything becomes more manageable. And you have to remember, if you believe it, that the, you know, U.S. does have over 8,100 tons of gold. Again, if you believe it, at current prices, that's still like $750 billion. But if there's some massive reset, that really could make a difference. So I think there's, you know, the people who are really projecting long term say, well, that's, you know, a real possibility too. It's not just that it supplants the dollar in part in terms of international trade. Not saying entirely, but in part, but that there could be this massive revaluation. So one never knows. These are just theses, and it's why you have to be, you know, hedged and diversified, because so many different moving parts here and so many different things that can send us in different directions, and none of them are particularly great.
Yeah. I want to turn topics, and I want to bring up small business. I know you're an expert in this. You've written about the war on small businesses. You testified recently before a congressional committee about small businesses, and they are truly the backbone of our economy. So let's start with like a broader question. How is the state of small business today in the U.S.?
Wow. Small businesses, you know, which you said that they're about, you know, half the private economy, they account for about half the jobs, but a larger percentage of new jobs that are created, they allow for people to really kind of take control of their wealth. And they are struggling. They have just had one thing after another. If you go back to the COVID mandates, those really fell squarely on the shoulders of small businesses, not based on data and science, but based on political clout and connections. And, you know, if I wanted to get my hair done at my local salon, I could not do that. But your dog could get its hair and nails done at a PetSmart or some other big box that was down the street that was said, oh, well, it's bigger, so it can be open, whatever that means. And then as those mandates kind of made their way through, we had the after effects of the mandates. We had a labor supply shortage. We had supply chain interruptions. We obviously had massive inflation. And all the benefits that had been sort of given to business over, you know, the ZERP period didn't really benefit small businesses as much because, you know, they don't have the ability to take down debt in the same at the same scale. A lot of small businesses have to personally guarantee that debt. So it's sort of, you know, where Wall Street really benefited, small business didn't. And then they had all this after effect. And now as like we're seeing, you know, Alignable does really great research. NFIB does really great research. But we're seeing these things pop up that, you know, 40 some odd percent of small businesses that have rents can't afford to pay their rent in full. Just really, really big challenges. And then you're getting all this legislation that's not removing barriers for them. It's creating barriers. And even when they're not directly targeted, they're impacted. When you think about California and it's $20 minimum wage for the fast food sector, it's like, well, small businesses are exempted. Well, are they really? Because if somebody can go work at a big box and get $20 an hour, that means that you have to be competitive with what else is in the market. So even if it's not mandated, it impacts you. When I went to Congress about, and I took with me statements from almost 450 small businesses and their supporters, and I had to, there were more, I had to cut it off because I had to go back and verify these before I put them on the congressional record, make sure that they were authentic, you know, people who lived in the U.S. and all that kind of stuff. But not only, you know, are they fighting this mass data collection program called the Corporate Transparency Act Beneficial Ownership Information Rule that is coming out of FinCEN, the Financial Crimes Division of Treasury, saying that the Financial Crimes Division wants small businesses to report not only their owners, but anyone who is a quote unquote important decision maker in a business, which in a small business could be anyone because everybody wears multiple hats. And that if you don't do this in a time frame, the penalties with inflation are up to almost $600 a day now, which means if you forget for a year, your penalty could be $215,000. And oh, by the way, on the criminal side, a $10,000 penalty plus jail time, just because, you know, you didn't comply with this, you know, insane thing. If you even have any idea who FinCEN is, and oh, by the way, all the big businesses are exempted. So when I asked for these statements for small businesses, so many of them not only opposed the statement, but were just talking about how hard it is for them to be in business and that they just don't understand why the government continually comes down and doesn't let them perform their business, but creates all of these additional hoops that they need to jump through that takes them away from running their business and then creates the asymmetric risk that if you don't do the things the government wants, that we're going to throw you in jail or bankrupt you with fines. It's just not worth it to people. And so I now have small business owners coming to me saying, should I dissolve my LLC? Should I get out of business? Because FinCEN wants to track them in a database. I mean, this is so not only unconstitutional, but just anti-American. And so it's a very frustrating time for small business that, you know, they really don't feel like anybody is on their side. I appreciate the House Committee on Small Business. They invited me. They're trying, but we need many more supporters or else we're just going to be, you know, left with a handful of big businesses and, you know, not have the vibrancy in our communities and, you know, with the opportunities that create the foundation for the American dream.
Yeah, you know, I just applied for an LLC and I got that thing. And I think I have to file it within like 90 days, 60 days.
Since you are a new LLC, after January 1st, 2024, it was 30 days. They moved it to 90, but just for this year. So if it's after January 1st of 2025, it reverts back to 30. So you have 90 days, Julia. And if you don't give your information, including a copy of your driver's license or your passport, and put it in this database, because they're going to try to fight money laundering and cartels
and
terrorism.
It's just for my YouTube channel. Maybe I shouldn't even do an LLC, you know? Maybe that was a bad idea. I don't know.
That's the challenge, though. If you forego that, then you forego the protections that go along with that. Yeah. And you should not have to make that choice. You should not have to choose between government overreach and having protection for your business. I think that is total bullshit. So here's the good news. The good news is that there is legislation to repeal. So call your representatives and call your senators, and this includes you, Julia, and tell them you want them to support the repealing Big Brother Overreach Act. In the Senate, it's sponsored by Tuberville. In the House, it's sponsored by Warren Davidson out of Ohio. And get them to overturn that. There's also court cases going on. So this could get killed in the courts too, but we need to pursue both paths. And if we get enough people, one of the things I heard in that committee, people are calling my office. So they know this is a deal. And if we make it a big deal, this will get killed.
Carol Roth, thank you so much for taking the time to join me today. This was such an interesting and important conversation. I appreciate you so much. And you are always welcome on this channel. I really appreciate you, Carol.
I appreciate you as well. Thank you for hosting these great conversations and look forward to maybe being invited back a fourth time.
Oh, you'll definitely be invited back. Maybe we'll do it in person as well. Anyway,
we'd love to do that.
Thanks again, Carol. Have a great rest of your day.
You too.